From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump holds bilateral meetings with Chinese President Xi Jinping Thursday, in which Mr. Trump has said he intends to press Xi to push North Korea to abandon its nuclear program. Mr. Trump arrived in Beijing Wednesday, his first visit as president to China, North Korea's closest ally. Trump is expected to call on China to expel North Korean workers from the country and otherwise eliminate some of its other dealings with Pyongyang. The talks between Trump and Xi will also deal with trade, which is a touchy subject since Mr. Trump has long complained about the trade deficit between China and the United States. The president suffered the sharpest political setback of his presidency Tuesday when Democrats swept two easy victories in governor's races in the states of Virginia and New Jersey. Democrats were ecstatic with their sweep of the two gubernatorial races and excited by a turnout that could have major implications for next year's congressional midterm elections when all 435 House seats and one-third of the Senate will be on the ballot. Democrats are pointing to exit polls in both Virginia and New Jersey that showed that anger at Mr. Trump was a major factor in stimulating Democrats to get to the polls. The president's administration announced that it is implementing changes that will channel economic activities away from Cuba's military, intelligence, and security services and impose travel and business limitations on Americans who interact with Cubans. Most Americans planning to visit the island nation will now have to travel with organized tour groups operated by U.S. companies. Travelers will also have to be accompanied by a representative of the sponsoring group. The State Department released a list of 83 hotels and other businesses that it says are associated with Cuba's military, including stores, marinas, and even two rum makers. This is VOA News. Vice President Mike Pence and his wife Karen headed to the small Texas town of Sutherland Springs to console the wounded survivors and families of the victims of the nation's latest mass murder. Mr. Pence spoke Wednesday at a prayer vigil for the 26 churchgoers shot dead during a Sunday morning service by gunmen with a history of mental health issues. Also meeting with law enforcement officials and the church neighbor who shot the gunman as he fled, potentially saving other lives. Before going to Sutherland Springs, Mr. Pence comforted 10 of the critically wounded survivors being treated at the Brook Henry Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte said that he planned on asking Beijing during this week's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation what its intentions are in the South China Sea and if Southeast Asian countries will be allowed to freely navigate the disputed strategic sea. We do get more from VOA's Steve Miller.
Evan Rees, an Asia-Pacific analyst with the Texas-based think tank Stratfor, states Duterte's approach may have another explanation.
His softer approach to China isn't because he is trying to pursue a softer approach permanently with China. It's because he's a Philippine nationalist, and he's trying to shore up the Philippines' position. The Philippines is in this vulnerable spot where it's a maritime nation that needs to shore up its claims in the South China Sea, but it also has all kinds of internal problems to deal with.
Now that Marawi has been retaken from militants and the Moro peace process is moving forward, Rees says Duterte now possesses the opportunity to push forward the Philippines' maritime interests. However, China claims almost the entire South China Sea, where some $3 trillion worth of goods passes through each year. Beijing also repeatedly denied that the Permanent Court of Arbitration had the jurisdiction to hear Manila's challenge and rejected the award.
The U.S. State Department is ending the Central American Minors Refugee Program, established to stem the flood of children attempting to enter the United States from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. The program, established in 2014 by the Obama administration, allowed certain parents lawfully residing in the U.S. to request a refugee resettlement interview for their children and eligible family members. But the Trump administration said it would end the program as part of its overall review of the refugees' admissions process. The State Department said the deadline to apply for the program is Thursday. While people from those countries seeking refugee status may still be eligible, they must use the normal refugee screening process. Since 2014, more than 1,500 children and eligible family members have arrived in the United States as refugees. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ouster Zimbabwe Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa has been expelled from the ruling ZANU-PF party and says he fears for his life.
I'm sure that he knows what the party is capable of, something which we've seen as civil society, which opposition politicians have seen. If you seem to be going against the status quo, there's always a danger.
Irene Petras is a human rights lawyer. Uganda's government appeals to striking medical doctors to return to work and save lives. The standoff continues between the South Sudan Army and former Army Chief General Paul Malong. And Cameroon's government condemns the murder of two police officers, allegedly by secessionists from the English-speaking regions.
This is a very well-conceived, organized, and implemented conspiracy by the secessionists. They decided to resort to arms in order to jeopardize the peace.
Issa Chiroma Bakari is Cameroon's information minister and a Liberian immigrant has been elected mayor of a U.S. city. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabwe Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa's political legacy took another hit on Wednesday when the ruling ZANU-PF party expelled him amid allegations that the former justice minister had left the country for South Africa. Gip Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service reports.
In a space of just 1 month, Emmerson Mnangagwa, Zimbabwe's once highly regarded politician and purported successor to President Robert Mugabe, lost his ministerial post as justice minister, his position as vice president, and now membership in the revolutionary ZANU-PF party. According to the state broadcaster ZBC, Zimbabwe Information Minister Simon Kayamoyo announced Mnangagwa's expulsion and the pending expulsions of, quote, all members identified as with Comrade Mnangagwa in his secessionist agenda, unquote. The decision by the Politburo, ZANU-PF's highest decision-making body outside Congress, follows further warning by President Robert Mugabe to anyone trying to undercut him. Mnangagwa, who has stayed out of the public view since the announcement, has reportedly left for South Africa, with reports varying from him experiencing health issues after the expulsion to hiding in fear of his life. Human rights lawyer Irene Petras says it's plausible that Mnangagwa, who has been accused of human rights violations during his tenure in government, may be in fear of his life.
I'm sure that he knows what the party is capable of, what people who do not support him can do. It's something which we've seen as civil society, which opposition politicians have seen. If you seem to be going against the status quo, there's always a danger.
Expulsions and suspensions of ZANU-PF members suspected to be disloyal to President Robert Mugabe or his party have been happening over the years and has seen some of the founding members like Mnangagwa and his predecessor Joyce Mjuru lose their positions and livelihoods. Many of the country's veterans who fought to bring independence to the country have also been expelled from the party amid accusations of siding with Mjuru or Mnangagwa. But spokesperson Victor Matematanda of the Zimbabwe National Liberation War Veterans Association, who is among those expelled, said he and his fellow veterans are now pushing for President Mugabe's expulsion from the party.
We have realized that no, Mugabe is expelling, is suspending, firing a lot of revolutionary people. When in actual fact, it is him who is retrogressive. And we decided that we should fire him the way we did Ndabaningi Stole.
Reverend Ndabaningi Stole is the late founder of the Zimbabwe African National Union, or ZANU, who was ousted from the party and replaced by Mugabe, who was then his Secretary General, over allegations of colluding with the British. A once loyal supporter of President Mugabe and ZANU-PF, Matematanda says Mugabe is equally guilty.
Remember, Mugabe is always accusing other people of being agents of the West, agents of the British, the Americans, and so forth. But people should not forget that Mugabe himself is a British knight. How did he get denied? He did not win crucial and critical battles for the Queen.
Britain stripped Mugabe of his knighthood in 2008. Zimbabwe First Lady Grace Mugabe has played a key role in facilitating the expulsions within the party, claiming support for her husband and the party's legacy. First Lady Grace Mugabe has expressed interest in running the country, claiming it's her right as a Zimbabwean. Analyst Joy Mapenge of Crisis and Zimbabwe Coalition says that scenario is very possible.
Clearly, it shows you that the scheming in ZANU-PF is now pointing towards the First Lady joining the presidium. The First Lady also being in the succession matrix, but that does not necessarily mean that the game is over yet. I think more is yet to come.
But political analyst Nkululeko Sibanda, who is based at Huddersfield University in the United Kingdom, says Mrs. Mugabe is simply securing her own future by making herself relevant.
When she started her campaign against Joyce Mujuru, it was an existential issue. It was about her realizing that as soon as Mugabe is out of the picture, she and her family are going to be answering for some of the problems that Mugabe is accused of, and that if she doesn't take over herself, then she may have to rely on somebody else protecting her and her family.
Many wonder whether they will come together as a party to challenge President Mugabe in the 2018 elections. Reporting for VOA Zimbabwe Service, I am Gibbs Dubey in Washington.
Cameroon's government has condemned the murders of three gendarmes, allegedly by secessionists from the country's English-speaking regions. Information Minister Issa Chiroma Bakari says the killings of the security officials are unacceptable since, he says, they were carrying out their mandate to protect life and property. Local media reported the secessionists killed three police officers in two separate attacks in the English-speaking city of Bamenda. Residents of the English-speaking areas have often accused the government of using state institutions like the police and the judiciary to intimidate and harass them, an allegation the government denies. Information Minister Issa Chiroma Bakari tells viewers Peter Clotty that the secessionists are resorting to arms and violence to force the agenda, but he says the government will not be deterred in its determination to maintain law and order.
This is a very well-conceived, organized, and implemented conspiracy by the secessionists. They decided to resort to arms in order to jeopardize the peace, to attack gendarmes, police, those in charge of securing and preventing the assault and aggression of secessionists. They decided now to resort to arms. Unfortunately, as you said, two of our brothers, gendarmes, were killed yesterday night, and the day before, we lost also another gendarme. To date, we have just lost three gendarmes.
So what is the government going to do about this, since this crisis appears to be ongoing and not stopping at all?
It is deplorable. The reason why they obstinately decided to press their ugly, unacceptable vision or decision to secede, to split the nation. They fail to understand that this is something which will never take place in Cameroon. It is deplorable. It is deplorable the fact that they resort to suppress life and to destabilize and disturb the smooth going of people's life in Bamenda and in some other areas in the northwest.
Some people are expressing concern that this is a reaction from people who the government have sent security operatives to arrest, to intimidate, to harass, and to beat them, and some of them who were unarmed were shot. What do you say to that?
It is completely wrong. This description does not reflect the reality at all. Their failed attempt to proclaim their independence took place the 1st of August, and today we are the 8th of November. Then why did this take place yesterday in the morning and today? Well, it is far from reflecting the reality. They have their own agenda, and they are implementing their agenda. Don't trust what they are saying. They want to resort to guns and ammunition and armaments in order to destabilize, thinking that through violence, they will compel the government into fulfilling their aim, which is completely wrong. Don't listen, don't accept one single moment the description and of what they are telling you. They are telling you, they're just leading you astray. They are misleading you, misinforming you.
The government opened negotiations with some of the opposition groups or those who are agitating in the Southwest. What was the conclusion of the discussion, and how do you implement recommendations from the meeting in order to resolve this crisis once and for all?
I want to allay your concern. I want to ease your mind and the mind of all of your listeners. The head of state has opened his heart, his arm, his mind, to discuss and to give whatever could be given in, with respect to our constitution and the law of the nation. No question is taboo, provided that it is enshrined in our constitution or according to the law of the nation.
Issa Chiroma Bakari is Cameroon's information minister. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Yaoundé. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 9th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Government officials in Uganda are appealing to medical doctors to end their strike and return to work to save lives. Jean Axen, the Minister of Health, says the government is working on a solution to meeting the doctors' demands by the end of this month. Mugumi Davis Rakarinch reports from Kampala, Uganda.
Industrial action is not now. Industrial action started at midnight. I'm not telling Ugandans that we work 25 hours a day, 8 days a week as doctors. And we want to be recognized for that. The reason we have come here is to launch the industrial action.
Hundreds of doctors cheered along on Monday as the head of Uganda Medical Association, a body that brings together medical doctors in Uganda, Dr. Obuku Okwaro, led them to launch their strike. Currently, entry-level doctors are paid 1.1 million Ugandan shillings, or about $300 per month, while senior doctors are paid 3.4 million Ugandan shillings, or about $900 per month. Doctors are demanding for the lowest paid doctor to earn 8.5 million Ugandan shillings, or about $2,400, and senior doctors be paid around $1,500 per month. While addressing journalists yesterday, Wednesday, Minister Acheng says the government is well aware of the demands medical doctors have put forward. But she says the government does not have enough funds to resolve the doctors' demands as yet.
The Ministry of Health, every financial year, when we are budgeting, the first item on our list is health worker remuneration. If you go backwards and look at all the ministerial policy statements, you will find it is there. The challenge is that we operate a cash budget. What comes in as revenue is what is expended. So it can only be addressed when there is an adequate amount. And because once you start a salary payment, it is not a one-off. Or if you start an allowance, it is not a one-off. It is continuous. So even before any undertaking, you have to think about sustainability, because once you start, you cannot stop.
Dr. Karubanda, the State Minister for Public Service, agrees.
The Minister of Public Service was tasked by Cabinet and indeed government to carry out a comprehensive review of salary across government. So we are about to be there, and as she has said, by the end of November, government will make a pronouncement on that issue.
Judicial workers and prosecutors are some of government employees that have recently laid down their tools demanding for better remunerations. As the strike by doctors goes on for the fourth day, today, thousands of patients across the country, especially those who cannot afford private clinics, remain without treatment. Karubanda says the government is concerned with the plight of its citizens and is thus engaging the concerned doctors to resume their work.
First of all, we have to feel sorry. Life is being lost. And as government, you know, this is a critical sector. A government cannot sit as life is being lost. So as the minister said, we are going to sit and make a very quick decision. The consequences, definitely, they are not desirable, but government is going to make the necessary steps to make sure that the situation ends. And that's why we are appealing to medical workers to resume, rather the doctors to resume their work.
Currently, there are about 2,300 practicing doctors across the country. For VOA News, I am Mugume. Davis Ruakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
In South Sudan, the standoff between the military and former army chief General Paul Malonga continues. General Malonga is under house arrest in the capital, Juba. South Sudan Information Minister Michael McQuay says community elders are mediating talks between Malonga and the government. YK Simon Wudu has the details from Juba.
The government on Saturday deployed soldiers to the route leading to the airport and around General Malong's residence after he resisted a presidential order to release a platoon of 30 soldiers guarding him. Dozens of well-armed soldiers can be seen standing on airport road on the approach to Malong's home beginning around Tomping Road near the former Beijing Hotel. When motor vehicles or border boarders get close, the soldiers raise their hands and direct traffic away. Following a six-hour cabinet meeting chaired by President Salva Kiir yesterday, Information Minister Michael McQuay told reporters that General Malong was informed several days ago that he must turn over his bodyguards to authorities.
General Malong, of course, when he was relieved, you know what he did. And when he came back here, he was allowed to go into his house and was allowed to stay with his forces. But of course, being a former chief of general staff, you cannot be allowed to continue with your platoon in your house.
McQuay says the Kiir administration decided to deploy soldiers around Malong's residence after he refused to obey the order to release his bodyguards.
The president had issued an order that these forces should go back to their respective positions, and that was resisted by the former chief of general staff. This is what brought about all this tension.
Former deputy governor of Lol State, Lual Dao, told the VOA South Sudan in Focus that the standoff may escalate to another conflict if not peacefully resolved. Lucy Ayaka, Malong's wife, also told the VOA on Monday that her husband's house has been surrounded and he cannot get out. Although she confirms peace talks between Malong and government are ongoing and are being mediated by community leaders, there has been no breakthrough. Juba residents appear relaxed but have expressed concerns about the deployment of forces, saying it poses a public security threat. Some roads near the deployment are not passable as soldiers have blocked commuters' access to them. Malong's house arrest and the subsequent deployment of forces has dominated media platforms across South Sudan, but McQuay insists the deployment is normal in the capital.
This is a normal security hiccups, and this is not new. These are things that happen in any country.
The United States Embassy in Juba on Monday posted a security alert on its website to American citizens due to the deployment of soldiers. McQuay says talks continue to peacefully resolve the standoff with the Malong.
We don't want this thing to be handled militarily because under the normal circumstances, it would have been a question of moving in the tanks and the whole thing is over, but we don't want that to happen. And this is why we are giving room for further contacts and interventions.
McQuay says he is confident the situation will be resolved soon. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
A Liberian refugee has been elected mayor of the U.S. city of Helena in the western state of Montana during Tuesday's midterm elections around the United States. Wilmot Collins says although he had experienced racial prejudice, the people of Helena have helped him work through the process. Collins and his wife fled Liberia's civil war in the mid-1990s and came to the United States looking for a second chance. Collins said he focused on two things: hard work and caring for his family. His message to Liberians and other Africans is that if you work hard and you are serious, you will always make it in the United States. But first, Collins explains to me how he and his wife ended up in the western state of Montana.
Well, James, I'll tell you this. Before the crisis in Liberia, my wife was an African exchange student in Helena. And she came to Helena, Montana and graduated from high school and went back. And that's how we met. And during the crisis, when we fled Liberia, all she talked about was Montana, Helena, Montana. She contacted her host family that she lived with. And the family started the ball rolling. They got her a full scholarship to do nursing. And she was able to come. And I joined her 2 years and 7 months later as a refugee.
So what type of campaign did you run?
First, I did an exploratory campaign where I spoke to the voters. I tried to seek out the issues that were important for them. We knocked on doors. We have forums. We spoke to almost everybody. I ran on a ticket with other two progressives who were running for commissioners. And all three of us won because the voters heard our issues. They heard our platforms, and that's what they wanted, and they spoke loudly.
You are in Montana. To be elected mayor of a city there, have you ever experienced anything like racial tension in your area, and how did you approach it?
You know, I always tell people I am very fortunate to live in the city of Helena, the capital city of Montana, because, yes, I have experienced racial tension, but the community embraced that and worked with me through the process. Like, I remember when I first came, people marked my home with KKK. But guess what? My neighbor who got together and my neighbor who washed my walls down. So that's why I love this community, because even though we do have a few people who are pretty negative, the overwhelming experience I've had here with my family has been positive.
There are those who are looking at Tuesday's election results from around the country as a referendum on President Trump. First of all, let me ask you, did you run as a Republican or as a Democrat? What's your party?
I will tell you no, because our municipal elections, they are nonpartisan. But I lean Democrat.
They just had elections in Liberia, October 10th, and there's a dispute in the election there. Any particular message from your end here, somebody who has participated in the democratic process here, any message for people, say, in Liberia or in Africa?
Yeah, what I want to tell my fellow Liberians is that we have to let the process play out. We cannot get involved in violence. Our country is way too delicate for us to even think about what I've been reading on the social media. Let the political process play out. I hear it's in the hands of the Supreme Court. Let the Supreme Court play it out.
If you want to tell people about America in Africa or anywhere around the world, what do you think America is? What does your election mean?
I always tell people, I say, look, when I fled Liberia, I was looking for a country that would give me a second chance. And I promised myself that chance will not be abused. And I ended up in Helena, Montana, a state that is 96% Caucasian. I ended up in this state, and the one thing I was focused on, caring for my family. Another thing I was focused on, working hard. What I'm trying to tell you is that if you work hard and you're serious, you'll make it. That's what America is.
Wilmot Collins is the Liberian immigrant who was just elected mayor of the U.S. city of Helena, the capital city of the western state of Montana. He was speaking with me from Helena. And that's it for this Thursday, November 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.